All right, good evening. Welcome to Great Decisions, Part 22. Tonight we discuss the raid on Entebbe, sponsored, as always, by Becky Navikatz, Ilunishisiona Ben Ravari Leib. The raid on Entebbe was called by Drew Middleton, a longtime military affairs correspondent for the New York Times. He called it an operation with no precedent in military history. And it's true, as you can add to that, it's an operation with no successor in military history. Once it was done, it would be impossible to duplicate because every terrorist would be on the alert for it. It's a stunning rescue that is the stuff of Hollywood movies, of which three were made. It was daring, it was audacious, it was almost flawlessly executed, a rescue mission that flew about 2,500 miles undetected, that's like from New York to Los Angeles, performed its mission in the most dangerous and hostile setting imaginable, and escaped with the hostages. And in so doing, Israel set an example to the world and reaffirmed its policy of not negotiating with terrorists, not succumbing to terrorist blackmail, and in fact of risking its soldiers' lives in order to save Jews anywhere in the world. The problem is, not all that is true, and especially, it almost didn't happen. The claim that Israel doesn't negotiate with terrorists was false even then, not to mention risibly false now. Remember the mid-90s, I asked such a question to a top aide of Yitzhak Rabin about Israel's appeasement of terror then, and he took offense, and he said, Israel does not negotiate with terrorists. And I said to him, no, so what is Yasser Arafat? And I got the blankest stare amid absolute silence from someone who was just parroting what he had been told to parrot. So how did it come about? What were the deliberations in the Israeli cabinet here? What decisions were made and unmade, and by whom? Now, the players are by and large known to us for many other accomplishments. They all had long, some still are around, alive and kicking, but they had long careers in the Israeli political establishment. Remember, this is less than 3 years after the Yom Kippur War. Yitzhak Rabin has been prime minister a little over 2 years. His foreign minister, with whom he had a warm relationship, was Yigal Alon. His defense minister, with whom he had an icy relationship, was Shimon Peres. Now, they were rivals for the leadership of the Labor Party. Peres was defeated in the first go-round. He saw himself as a potential prime minister, as he always did. As, by the way, he still does at the age of 90. He saw himself as more suited to the office than Rabin, and they were barely civil to each other. Rabin had not wanted him in the cabinet to begin with, even initially rejected Peres as a candidate for defense minister until it became clear that he would not be able to form a government without him, and so he conceded. Their relationship did not really improve until Rabin was assassinated in 1995. And that bitterness would surface during these events as well in the decision and certainly in the accounts of the event. The chief of staff was Mordechai Gur. Remember, his division led the successful assault on Yerushalayim in 1967 on the Har HaBayit, who had uttered the immortal, if somewhat premature, words, Har HaBayit Biyadeinu, Har HaBayit Biyadeinu. So, what happened? A hijacking began as a tool of terrorists in the 1960s. Planes were seized by marauders, in our context, often flown to Cuba. It became indelibly associated with Arab terror in the late 1960s when planes were hijacked. First an El Al plane in 1968, flown to Algeria. In 1970, three foreign planes were hijacked, taken to Jordan, blown up. That precipitated Black September, blown up after the passengers were evacuated. One of them, of course, was Rav Huttner. Obviously, and most famously, after the first few hijackings, one El Al cargo plane, in fact, exploded in the air, El Al became the world's experts in security, and none of their planes have been attacked in over 40 years. The Arabs eventually shifted away from hijacking planes to attacking airports, and then they graduated to car bombs and suicide bombs and of course to flying planes into buildings. Now, other airlines were not as swift in adopting security measures, and so it was. On Sunday, June 27th, 1976, an Air France plane, Airbus 300A, flight 139, carrying 246 passengers, flew out of Ben-Gurion Airport en route to Paris via Athens. In Athens, they'd be picking up another 56 passengers, and so they did, including four terrorists. Now, the accounts of the Times reveal that some of the Israelis on board had bad vibes about these individuals, at least two of them, and even complained to airline officials, but security in Athens was very lax. In fact, it was the second time something like this happened in Athens to flights from Israel. In 1968, terrorists began firing and throwing grenades at an El Al flight in Athens as it was traveling down the runway about to take off. In fact, one passenger was killed. A bullet went through the plane and just killed him. Several were wounded. The terrorists were arrested. One was sentenced to 17 years in prison, and he served 4 months. Moved to Canada upon his release, where apparently he still lives. Not much in Athens improved in the ensuing years. In fact, there'd be another attack in Athens after this. Some airlines had even responded to the terrorist threat by announcing that their crews would not resist, essentially an open invitation to violence. A man and a woman boarded Wilfried Biza and Bridget Kuhlman, she with an Ecuadorian passport, he with a Peruvian, both were Germans. Both had been ticketed earlier that week in Kuwait, didn't attract any attention. Another two boarded as well, also with tickets from Kuwait, both young Arabs from the Gulf, Jalil al-Arja and Abdul Latif Abul Razik al-Samrai. Well, I think that's an alias, but who knows? The passengers noticed them. Some even commented that they looked like terrorists, but the flight took off anyway at 12:25 p.m. 8 minutes later, two rushed the cockpit. Passengers began screaming. They kicked the door in and with guns drawn commandeered the plane. They had guns, they had grenades, and they showed them to everyone. The Air France pilot, Michel Bakos, was very calm and controlled, and he actually was a hero throughout this event, never leaving his passengers despite being offered his release. Within 30 minutes, the airport authorities in Israel received a report that the plane was missing, not responding to radio contact. And it was an hour later, 1:57 p.m., that they learned that the plane was hijacked. On board, the passengers were informed by the terrorists that the plane was hijacked by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, but under the control of the terrorist Wadi Haddad, not the one that you thought. That group was a spin-off from the main PFLP under the control of George Chabash. The hijackers were these two Arabs and two Germans as well, on loan, I guess, for the event from the revolutionary cells in Germany. And they told the passengers the crime was committed to protest the Zionist crimes in Israel against the Arabs, and all supported, the Zionists were supported by France and Germany and other countries, and that's why it happened. Plane landed first in Benghazi, Libya. It's been in the news also the last couple of years for refueling, but they wound up on the ground for 9 hours. None of the passengers was allowed to deplane. And Gaddafi had no interest in becoming involved and eventually forced the plane to leave. Actually, in fact, one passenger was allowed to leave, very interesting, an Israeli woman of British origin named Patricia Martel, a nurse. And she planned it. She thought what to do, how to get off, and she pretended to be pregnant and about to miscarry. She cut herself on her upper thigh to make it look like she was bleeding. She was taken off the plane and oddly examined by a doctor in Libya. She wasn't really pregnant, but she was taken for the night to a luxury hotel in Benghazi. She hid her Israeli passport, showed them her British passport. The next day she was put on a plane to London, where she was the first to provide intelligence to the Mossad. In Israel, the cabinet was meeting in regular session when it was interrupted with news of the hijacking. And in the first of many disputes about this event, both Rabin and Peres, in their memoirs, claimed to have been notified first. Meanwhile, the planes took off, and the plane took off, headed in the direction of the Sudan, and there was panic among the leadership when they heard that. First, they were afraid of the plane being crashed in Israel. It's always a nightmare because you don't know what to do. You can't, I mean, unfortunately, we experienced this also on September 11th, the Arab terror. It's hard to shoot down a passenger plane, and certainly one that's filled with Israelis coming to Israel. They don't want them to crash into a building, kill even more people. It soon became clear that was not the plan, but they were even more afraid of the plane landing in a hostile Arab country where they would have absolutely no leverage, like Sudan. In any event, the government here was weak. It had lost seats to the Likud in the election, in the preceding election, right after the Yom Kippur War. After the war, it had been forced by Henry Kissinger into a series of withdrawals from the Sinai and from the Golan, including the Abu Rodeis oil fields that Israel had discovered in 1974 and surrendered to the Egyptians a year later. So they were floundering, and part of it was the relentless personal hostility between the two leaders. It was already clear that Peres would run in the primaries against Rabin for the leadership in next year's election, 1977. He eventually did and lost, but then he became the Labor candidate opposing Menachem Begin in any event when Rabin had to resign when he admitted to holding an American bank account in violation of Israeli law. At this point, if the results of the hijacking were unfortunate, the government would certainly fall, and Rabin saw his career ending. And as the initial results, initial reports came in, the government had little that they could do. The Sayert Matkal was first dispatched to the airport that Sunday. In case the plane landed in Israel, they would take over the plane as they had been trained, but that came to naught. At 3:15, Monday afternoon, a day later, the plane landed at Entebbe Airport in Uganda, straddling Lake Victoria and Kenya, about 20 miles southwest of Kampala, the capital. It was immediately surrounded by Ugandan soldiers. The passengers disembark and are taken to the old airport terminal, where they are greeted by Uganda's dictator, the mercurial, that is to say, insane, Idi Amin Dada. They were also greeted by three other terrorists, at least three other terrorists. I think in the end, eight were in total were there, including Khaled al-Sid, who was the PLO representative in Uganda. Interestingly, Idi Amin had long relationships with the Israelis. He had been chief of staff. He moved up the ranks with the help of Israeli advisors, and especially with military aid that Israel provided Uganda. He claimed in his biography to have performed great military feats in battle, but in reality he had only been a cook in the rear. He'd been to Israel many times over the years, I shouldn't say many, maybe a half dozen times, maybe a little less than that, including treatment for syphilis in a hospital in Tel Aviv, where, irony of ironies, one of his nurses had been Patricia Martel, the aforementioned woman who had just disembarked in Benghazi. Amin even had on his personal staff in Kampala an Israeli psychiatrist who ministered to him regularly. One time, I think it was 73, 74, he asked one Israeli visitor for Tzanchanim wings, paratrooper wings, that were one of the medals he wore on his chest, an Israeli as a tzanchan, even though he never jumped from a plane in his life. He was especially close with a number of Israelis, including Baruch Barlev, who had been the military liaison in Kampala. In short, Amin was mentally ill and quite ruthless, a terrible combination. By 1976, he had turned against Israel because of a series of personal insults that he could not abide, including the recall of Burka Barlev, and especially the reduction of Israeli military aid. The Israelis deemed him a little too volatile to become the recipient of anything more. As soon as the Israelis found out that the plane was in Uganda, they were somewhat relieved, at least it wasn't in an Arab country, but also perplexed, which Idi Amin would they encounter? Next day, Tuesday, the demands were made. The terrorists sought the release of 40 terrorists held in Israel and more than a dozen in other countries, West Germany, France, Kenya, and Switzerland. Who knew the Swiss even held terrorists? And within 48 hours, July 1st, 2 p.m., they wanted them in Entebbe or else. The terrorists were to be flown to Entebbe. There the exchange would be made. That was the initial offer. Prime Minister Rabin issued a terse statement that Tuesday saying the safety of the passengers was the responsibility of the French government as it was their plane that was hijacked. But of course, it was more complicated than that. So what in fact did they decide? Amid the gravity of the moment, reading the memoir literature of the time reveals the animosity that pervaded the upper echelons of the Israeli government. Late Tuesday afternoon, Rabin called together a small group, six ministers, in special session, and included the chief of staff. Rabin writes in his memoirs that Peres said, well, Gur is unavailable, he's watching maneuvers in Sinai. And he said, so we'll send for him by helicopter, meaning that Peres didn't understand what the seriousness was. At the meeting, Rabin writes, he asked Peres, has the IDF explored the possibility of a military operation? That would be our first preference. If not, we shall consider negotiating with the hijackers. So Rabin writes that Peres answered, the matter was not yet under consideration. And then he says, writing in 1979, Peres was speaking the truth, and a deplorable truth it was. 53 hours after the hijacking, he had yet to consult the chief of staff on possible military means of releasing the hostages. End quote. Conversely, Peres wrote that he immediately began such preparations, even visiting the Sayeret Matkal base, but it was Rabin who was opposed to any military action, and that Rabin had panicked immediately and said, they'll throw children off the plane, they'll kill all of them, we have no other option, we have to negotiate with the terrorists. Gur went to work with his staff, all of them illustrious fighters. Don Shomron planned the operation, later became chief of staff. Almost as importantly, Charles Bronson played him in the movie. Yekutiel Adam, the operational commander, became deputy chief of staff a few years later. He was actually named to be the head of the Mossad in 1982, or about to be named, when he was killed in Lebanon during the war by an RPG fired at him by a 12-year-old boy. Apparently, the soldiers did not shoot this boy so as not to be accused of killing children. So Kuti Adam remains the highest-ranking Israeli soldier, major general, ever killed in combat. Ehud Barak was a colonel at the time, a key planner alongside Shomron. And of course, Yonatan Netanyahu, who was the commander of Sayeret Matkal, the innocently named general reconnaissance unit that performed special commando operations. Netanyahu was born in New York City in 1946. Remember, his father, Professor Benzia Netanyahu, Olav Shalom, had come to fill the void after Jabotinsky died in 1940. He started what he called the New Zionist Organization of America, right-wing revisionists. They all returned to Israel when Yoni was two, and then came back to America in the 1950s. Netanyahu the Elder was a right-wing academic, professor, historian, and he was persecuted by the socialist establishment. So he came here to teach, became a professor at Dropsy, and then at Cornell, where he spent decades. Yoni Netanyahu returned to Israel for military service in 1964. He fought in the Six-Day War in both the Sinai and the Golan. He then married. He returned to the U.S. to study at Harvard. He went back to Israel to fight in the war of attrition. He was a poetic soul. He was a sensitive soul. But ultimately, he was a restless soul, bouncing back and forth between the college and the army, between Harvard, the IDF, Hebrew U, the IDF. He divorced in 1972, and then he became Tzva Keva, permanent army, during and then after the Yom Kippur War, rising to be, as a lieutenant colonel, the commander of Sayeret Matkal at the age of 30. But by Tuesday night, then by Wednesday night, there was still no feasible plan. And Gur writes that he was troubled by the constant tension between Rabin and Peres. A suggestion was made. It was the first plan that commandos land in Kenya, take a boat across Lake Victoria. It's a pretty substantial body of water, by the way. But take a boat across Lake Victoria, kill the terrorists, and then appeal to Amin for their release. That was rejected because Gore said Idi Amin would likely be very unaccommodating. Now, something else happened on Tuesday that was ominous and sent chills throughout Israel, was somewhat misleading. On Tuesday, the passengers were separated and only the Israelis were held. Some of those passengers were Holocaust survivors, and the selection carried out by the German terrorist Beza brought back nightmares. But in fact, this was a nightmare. At the time, the reports were that the Jews were separated from the non-Jews, but that turned out later to be untrue. So said Ilan Hartov, who was an ex-bureaucrat in the foreign ministry, who became the official spokesman for the hostages with the terrorists. He'd been accompanying his mother, Dora Bloch, to a family simcha, a wedding in New York, when the plane was hijacked. He said just a few years ago that the terrorists confiscated the passports and they singled out the Israelis and the dual passports. But there are many Jews included in the group that was freed and flown to Paris later that day. Two of them, he says, were Brazilian Jews, young Brazilian Jews, yeshiva students that come for the year to learn. Remember, it's the end of June now. The year was over. And they were sent to be with the Israelis when the terrorists saw them davening with talis and tefillin in the morning. But Hartov intervened with what they call the Peruvian, one of the Germans, and in fact the Brazilian Jews were released, along with some other Jewish, but not Israeli couples. There were, though, some people with dual passports who could have left, and they insisted on staying. One of them eventually died. Indeed, one Holocaust survivor present, Yitzhak David, later the deputy mayor of Kiryat Bialik, said to the German Beza, I quote, when the selection was going on, he said, "I see nothing in Germany has changed in 30 years. Now, very interesting, he reports that Beza became very defensive and said he was not a Nazi, that in fact it was the German government. They were the ones who brought in reactionaries into positions of power, and that here he committed terrorist acts just to help the underdogs, the Palestinians," to which Yitzhak David responded, "Okay, when the Palestinians throw us into the sea, I'll come to you, and together we can hijack Arab planes." Never lose a sense of humor. But Hartov thought that on some level they'd gotten through to Beza. That played a role later, perhaps. Although the female German, Kuhlmann, they said she behaved like a real Nazi. To their credit, Captain Michel Bakos and his entire crew refused to join the non-Israelis who were flown to Paris, and instead they stayed with the Israeli hostages. By Wednesday evening, it was June 30th, Rabin announced to the cabinet that Israel had no choice to negotiate and to surrender to the terrorist demands. And that, again, you have these two different accounts from both of them. That prompted an outcry from Peres. Rabin called it demagogy. Peres gave a speech, "Israel cannot capitulate to terrorists." And Rabin retorted, as he records it, I quote, "Our problem at the moment is not rhetoric. If you have a better proposal, go ahead. What do you suggest?" The defense minister maintained a dignified silence, end quote. Indeed, Rabin had reached out to Menachem Begin, head of the opposition, early that day. And Begin, kedarko, in times of national crisis, promised Rabin his full support in whatever was decided, even to negotiate. When Rabin announced this to the cabinet after Peres spoke, he wrote, "Begin's display of national responsibility descended on Peres like a cold shower, cooling his demagogy." Rabin was moved by Begin's support, and at least he knew that the opposition would not seek to make political hay out of the crisis. The cabinet then voted unanimously, including Peres, to negotiate the terms of surrender. Both chief rabbis weighed in, Rav Goren and Rav Yosef, urged the release of the terrorists. In truth, for all the mythology surrounding Israel's dealing with terrorists, it was a long history of surrendering to terror and then denying it or minimizing it. What's happened in the last 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, is really nothing new. Entebbe was the exception. In August 1968, when the first our plane was hijacked to Algeria, Israel freed terrorists in order to secure the release of the plane and the passengers after 40 days of captivity, and they claim they released old, infirm, invalid, low-level terrorists as a humanitarian gesture, none of which was true. But more recently, after the Yom Kippur War, Israel had released hundreds of terrorists, not just Egyptian soldiers, and terrorists in exchange for the dead bodies of Israeli soldiers, and that became an issue in the cabinet as well. It was mostly the same people who had voted in late 1973 to approve, or early 1974, who approved the prior exchange. So how could they justify trading terrorists for bodies and not trade terrorists for living Jews? But as I noted earlier, the fiction that Israel does not surrender to terrorists, even to Arafat, is very important to the Israeli psyche. There's a lot of cognitive dissonance going on. Compounding the situation, and especially once their nationals were released, both France and Germany announced they would not free any terrorists. And interestingly, Israel applied pressure on both France and Germany not to concede, right? That's also part of the process. They may concede, but if you concede, you're spineless, feckless haters of Jews. Thursday morning, the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee approved the negotiations as well. The New York Post headlined, "Israel surrenders." That was the headline. And it was not a ruse. A back channel opening to France for a joint French-Israeli rescue operation went nowhere. Israel was stuck. And as the Thursday 2 p.m. deadline neared, its first approach was to buy time. This was done through enlisting the efforts of Burka Barlev, the former military liaison chief, to whom Idi Amin remained very close. Barlev called a number of times, and the transcript of their conversations is filled with the type of flowery praise that has to be showered on an insane person. So Burka Barlev started, "Your Excellency, my great friend, when I heard the news on the radio, I said, now, Idi Amin Dada, my friend, has his great opportunity, his great chance to do something great. Everyone will be speaking about you. Please stop all the bloodshed. If you save people, you'll be a holy man. You will win the Nobel Prize," etc., etc. With the negotiations now underway, it was Rabin's advisor on terror, Rechavam Ze'evi, known as Gandhi, who reviewed the terrorist list, the prisoner list, and he insisted, and again, the echoes, we hear this today as well, he insisted that no terrorist with blood on his hands, meaning anyone who killed or wounded Israelis, would be freed. Even that benchmark no longer exists, and it's hard to say they would have adhered to it even then. But something did happen. Through Idi Amin and the French, the deadline for surrender was postponed for 72 hours until 11 a.m. Kampala time, Sunday, July 4th. It was Benny Peled, who was the commander of the Air Force, who came up with the idea initially, in very rough form, to land planes at the airport in secret, take over the airport, and then work from there. But the logistics were daunting. The C-130 Hercules transport planes Israel had could fly the attacking force had a range that was just about the flight distance to Entebbe. So where would they refuel? Just think that you have to fly down the Red Sea towards the Persian Gulf. They make a right turn over Kenya, near Somalia, and there. It's a very long trip. They're all hostile countries on either. So wherever you're flying, they're all hostile except for Kenya. Where would they refuel? How could they conceal their arrival so as not to engage the Ugandan Air Force or alert the hijackers to their arrival? And remember, it's not only hijackers of the airport. There are dozens of Ugandan soldiers that are standing guard as well. It was also ominous when the Israeli realized the Ugandans are cooperating with the terrorists. Indeed, where were the hostages being held? What did the terminal look like? What floor were they being held on? Were they all in one place? While not every question could be answered with complete satisfaction, no unit could engage the target completely blind. It would be a disaster. So Peled wanted first to land 1,000 paratroopers, drop them over the airport, have them descend, and capture the airport that way. But Gur was opposed, because he feared that the paratroopers would be easily detected, and by the time they got to the terminal, the hostages would be dead. Another plan was to send Moshe Dayan, whom Idi Amin adored, to Uganda, but Rabin rebuffed that as too risky. But then the plan took shape. A team from Sayeret Matkal and two other units would land under cover of darkness at Entebbe. They would fly low over Lake Victoria to avoid radar detection and land at the airport on the heels, right in back of a previously scheduled British cargo plane. They wouldn't be noticed at all. Over 2 days, almost every question found potential resolution. Amin had let slip to Burka Barlev the location in the building of the captives and the terrorists. They had a rough layout of the airport because it was built by Solel Bonet, the Israeli company, but they lacked any update information. The plans were 5 years old. So on Shabbos, a Mossad operative flew to Kenya, rented a plane, Shabbos morning, July 3rd, and he pretended to have plane trouble over Lake Victoria that would require him to circle Entebbe Airport twice to recalibrate. He notified the air traffic controllers at Entebbe, and they approved. So he flew low over the airport, took high-density photographs of the old terminal, photographs that reached the attacking force when they were sitting on the Hercules waiting to take off. And other valuable information was provided by some of the freed prisoners who are now in France, including one with a military background and a phenomenal memory, who reported on locations, gave a whole layout, distance, area, as well as the various weaponry in possession of the terrorists. The question was, though, the planes land. How do they get from the landing to the terminal? How would they ensure that the terrorists didn't open fire on the raiders or on the hostages? How they make their getaway without having to fight the Ugandan soldiers? You can plan and plan, and nothing ever goes perfectly, and then you have to improvise. But the margin of error was very, very small here. The margin of error between success and catastrophe is infinitesimally small. And Sayeret Matkal remembered quite well, just 2 years earlier, a failed hostage rescue in Malot resulted in 27 deaths, including 21 children. That was a catastrophe. And Yoni Netanyahu's deputy, Muki Betzer, had been there. And what happened was they came in and the terrorists started firing on the hostages, and the Israelis killed some and the terrorists killed more, and it was a disaster. But Kenya turned out to be extremely helpful. Due to the intervention of President Jomo Kenyatta, by his agriculture minister, Bruce McKenzie, the Mossad was given full access to Kenyan territory as of Friday. First, though, a plan had to pass cabinet approval. It's Peres, in his writings, who claims that notwithstanding the decision to negotiate, he was the one to push for a military option. Rabin denied that emphatically. Recall at this time, President Kennedy's famous statement after the Bay of Pigs: success has many fathers, failure is an orphan. This is a success, so it has many fathers. It was a fundamental dispute. And by the way, remember also that the Israeli government now is top-heavy in generals, including the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister and others. It's not just the Chief of Staff and not just the military. It's everyone in the government. It was a fundamental dispute that raged Friday over the size of the commando force. Generals always, like we know this from our recent history, even in Iraq and Afghanistan, generals always want more soldiers, more of everything, because more makes a greater impact. So some wanted to land maybe 10 planes with armored vehicles. Were they able to fight a pitched battle between the IDF and the terrorists and the Ugandans? The Ugandans were correctly assumed to be helping the terrorists. a small force could be easily wiped out, so hit him with a large force. That was a fear of Matagur. On the other hand, a large force would cause the element of surprise to be lost, and that would endanger the hostages who would be killed by the Arabs before they could be liberated. As a plan took shape, Paris had no military background, by the way. He tracked down one of his mentors, Moshe Dayan, and of all places, he was eating in a restaurant in Tel Aviv, took him aside, he explained to him the highlights of the plan, really just took a table on the side, and Dayan said, "You must do it." The inner cabinet met Friday morning, and Paris, remember this, Paris then, in the 70s, up to the mid-80s, was perceived as one of the hawks in Israel. He met with someone else in the inner cabinet of six, Chaim Tzadok, the justice minister, who was not in favor, to try to convince him of the wisdom of supporting a military operation. It required so many moving parts that had to work together seamlessly. The surprise, the speed, eliminating the terrorists while minimizing engagement with the Ugandans and spiriting out the hostages, who now numbered 105 souls, taking them from Uganda. Rabin was still hesitant, as was Gur, but, and all accounts are subject to the political considerations of the writers, Rabin did inform Gur on Friday that no plan was perfect, and that casualties could be expected, but the long-term harm of surrender was even greater. On Friday, Yoni Netanyahu's outfit, together with a Golani and a Tzanchan contingent, practiced the assault on a mock-up of the old Entebbe terminal that had been hastily designed, but that was just the last stage. There was much more to practice, especially the landing and the exit from the Hercules. Approval was given late Friday morning to rehearse. And Friday night, a rehearsal took place at Sharm el-Sheikh. Sharm el-Sheikh was used to cut down the flying time. A cabinet meeting was called for Shabbos afternoon, Pikuach Nefesh, remember, 2 p.m. Religious ministers were put on notice on Friday so they'd be able to walk. Begin was told to come and be briefed at 3 o'clock. There was one last hurdle. How to get from the runway to the terminal building undetected? So Yoni Netanyahu's group would be the first to charge the building. In fact, he would be the first, but had to get there. So it was Kuti Adam's deputy who devised the scheme of using a black Mercedes, such as Idi Amin rode, but really all Ugandan generals had a black Mercedes, to make it appear as if the arriving party was Ugandan. It turns out what they didn't know was that in the few weeks before, Amin had changed to a white Mercedes to distinguish him from the generals, but on Friday, Gur was still reluctant, but when he saw the rehearsal Friday night, he gave the go-ahead. In the meantime, Gandhi, Rucham Zevi, is still in France, still negotiating with the French over the list of terrorists to be handed over. At 2 p.m. Shabbos afternoon, Rabin assembled the cabinet, reported to them that there was now a viable military rescue plan. He reviewed with them a rough sketch of the details, and then he informed them that the planes had already taken off from Sharm el-Sheikh, but they could be recalled if the cabinet voted down the mission. Now, Rabin had remained hesitant until one last detail fell into place. It was on Shabbos morning that the Kenyans agreed to allow refueling after the mission. It was only that morning they agreed that Uganda actually was the military power in the region and the Kenyans were afraid of them. Now, some ministers complained about the obvious pressure that was placed on them. Planes ready in the air. But Rabin assured them other missions had been aboard in the past if necessary. If they voted down, they'll just call the planes back. Approval was then given unanimously, reversing the decision of Thursday. They all got up, and Yosef Boer gave a clap, and he said, "One second." And he read from that morning Sedra, Parshas Chukas, Vayishmak Na'ani Melech Arad Yosef HaNegev Ki Vo Yisrael Derech HaTarim. Kanani heard this was coming up through the Negev, the south, Vayilochem Yisrael, and he fought against Israel, Vayishmi Menu Shevi, and he took captives. Vaidar Yisrael neder lemor, and Israel vowed to Hashem, If you give this nation, Canaan, into my hands, will destroy their cities. The mission was named Mivtza Kadur Haram, Operation Thunderball, not chosen by Ian Fleming, but actually chosen by computer. In all, four C-130 Hercules transports were involved, all with a different part of the mission. The first, piloted by Yoshua Shani, carried the primary attacking force, and the planes flew separated by a few minutes southward over the Red Sea at a height sometimes of 100 feet so as not to attract the radar attention of the Saudis. Nor was there any radio contact the whole time they left Sharm el-Sheikh until they landed. At a certain point, they headed west over Kenya towards Lake Victoria. The 7.5-hour flight, maximum speed of the Hercules, 365 miles per hour. Yoni Netanyahu sat on the plane in the Mercedes, in the front passenger seat. That's how they would head out. The engines of the vehicle were started when the planes were about 100 feet over the airport. How does that, how do you start start an engine of a car inside a plane? But I guess they knew they were landing. When the plane landed at 11.03 p.m., the first vehicles, the Mercedes and some Land Rover Jeeps, exited. They drove past some Ugandan soldiers, and then one tried to stop them, and he was shot but not killed. Within 2 minutes, that's 11.05, they're at the terminal. 29 men in all. The squad rushed the doors. They shot Ugandan soldiers at the doors, but that alerted everyone else. As they entered the room, they shouted, "Stay down, stay down. We are Israeli soldiers. We've come to take you home." They kept shooting terrorists. They kept a count of how many terrorists were killed. Some hostages pointed them to the second floor. Three were eliminated there. There were some reports, and this goes back to what I said before, the conversation between Wilfried Biza and Yitzhak David. There were some reports that Biza pointed his Kalashnikov at the hostages and then thought better of it, lifted it towards the soldiers, and he was shot dead immediately, as was his Nazi woman friend on the second floor. Now it seems that the terrorists were liquidated within 30 seconds of entry into the building, maybe even 15 seconds, when the force, because Netanyahu just emphasized during the training, speed, speed, speed. Speed was most important because speed had been their enemy at Maalot. They had to get into the building, use their surprise to kill those who looked like terrorists, and then try to leave as quickly as possible. When the force entered, one hostage stood up, a young Moroccan Jew, Arab face, Jean-Jacques Maimouni of Netanya, 19 years old, stood up, looked like an Arab, and he was killed. Two other hostages, Pasco Cohen and Ida Barovich, were also killed, it seems all by friendly fire, maybe crossfire. There were weak points in the operation. Obviously, nothing can ever be perfect. They knew where the hostages were, and they knew where the terrorists were, but the old terminal had a traffic control tower where Ugandan soldiers were stationed, and that was much more difficult to capture in a short time. And they continued to fire. Some say Yoni Netanyahu was killed from the tower, but those who were there, who wrote about it, his brother wrote a book about it, said he was shot by a Ugandan soldier hiding behind a crate on the ground level, same level, shot in the chest, eggs in the back, basically went through the heart. As the assault first began, he never even made it into the building. He died within a few minutes of internal loss of blood while being treated by the medical staff. His deputy, Muki Betzer, was already in the building, and he took command. The second Hercules landed 6 minutes after the first. It contained paratroopers under the command of Matan Vilnai and another Sayert Matkal force commanded by Shaul Mofaz. The first group went to neutralize the new terminal and the second to clear the airfields and to protect the getaway route. When storming the new terminal on the second floor, the force encountered Ugandan soldiers who opened fire. Sergeant Surin Hershko, what a sad situation. He was finishing his 3 years in the army. The next day, July 4th, was his discharge. He was shot. One bullet missed. The second bullet penetrated his neck, and he's been a paraplegic ever since. Shattered his spine. Within 4 minutes, 11:07 p.m., Kuti Adam reported that everything is fine. The Poshim had been eliminated. Gur, back in Tel Aviv, the chief of staff, asked Dan Shamron on the ground, what's happening? It's 4 minutes into the assault. And Shamron answered, everything is all right. I'll report later. I'm busy now. True. There was scattered gunfire still. Ugandans were firing from the control tower. That took several minutes more to pacify. And then the evacuation began, and time was of the essence. Now, strange, but maybe not too surprising, it took about 45 minutes to get 100 people into a plane that was just maybe 200 feet away, not very far. The hostages had to be gathered together and counted and recounted. They wanted to make sure that no one was missing. Some, in fact, were in the washroom. It was late at night, 11 o'clock, when the shooting erupted. Incredibly, as they were being rushed to the tarmac where the Hercules planes were parked, one ran back in to get the duty-free items he had purchased. Some of them were dragging their luggage and carry-ons with them. It wasn't enough to be saved. Not going to leave their belongings behind. One stewardess was already in her bed, lying down in her underwear. She had to be carried out by one of the soldiers because she wanted time to get dressed. Mofaz's unit destroyed 11 MiGs on the ground, so the planes could not be followed. At 11:53 p.m., 50 minutes after they landed, the plane with the hostages, the dead, and the wounded was in the air. Within a short time, all the planes had left. A total of 105 hostages were rescued. One hostage was left behind. Unbeknownst to the Israelis, the elderly Dora Bloch, mother of Ilan Hartuv, had been hospitalized on Friday after choking on a piece of meat. Her son told the Muki Betzer that he doesn't want to leave without his mother. He'll stay behind. And he was told, if you stay behind, you'll be dead. She has a chance to live because maybe they won't kill an elderly woman. Unfortunately, it was not so. The next day, when Idi Amin realized what had happened, his secret police dragged her, kicking and screaming, from the hospital, took her to a sugar plantation, and shot her to death. Her body was partially burned and was only discovered years later. Amin also realized the involvement of the Kenyans initially, and with the refueling, and the Kenyans even provided medical care of the wounded to Israelis. Yitzhak David, mentioned before, and another were operated on in Kenya, spent a few more days there, and so within a year or two they assassinated Bruce McKenzie, who was the Kenyan minister who had helped Israel. Amin, by the way, survived only another 3 years. He was deposed in 1979, and he lived another almost 25 years. He died a decade ago. He lived out the rest of his life in Saudi Arabia. Go figure. In Israel, Lehudim Aysa Ora V'Simcha V'Sason V'Kar, Galei Tzahal was the first to announce the news at 3 a.m. And when the soldiers aboard the Hercules heard this, they were furious, because they still hadn't returned. Another 4 or 5 hours flight time left, and they couldn't counter hostile Arab aircraft. But nonetheless, it was announced. I remember it well because I was there. I was in Israel at the time. I was finishing my year in Israel, staying for the summer. And I heard about it in the morning. And as we know, that day, July 4th, 1976, was the bicentennial celebrations. And I remember traveling from Netanya to Yerushalayim to join the bicentennial celebrations at Givat Ram Stadium at the Hebrew U. And it was an electric atmosphere. I remember looking upward, driving to Tel Aviv, or riding a bus to Tel Aviv, and just you could sense the Yad Hashem. Just amazing. People just hugging and dancing in the streets. At Ben Gurion Airport, the families gathered to welcome their loved ones. No one knew yet there were any casualties. As the hostages deplaned, two families announced over the intercom, will the Maimuni and Borovich families please come to the office? Pasco was with his wife and children. He was killed, so they knew. These two families still remember with bitterness being informed that their loved ones had been killed. We're outside the room, literally outside the very small partition. There's a raucous celebration going on. And some of them remain bitter until today that they've been ignored in the ensuing years because they're a downer on what was really a miraculous mission. In the U.S., a young MIT student, himself a veteran of Sayeret Matkal, Benjamin Netanyahu, was awakened by a contact in his old unit, and he was told that his older brother had been killed. He drove from Boston to Philadelphia to inform his parents. Together they flew back to Israel. Ben Zion and Tzilin Netanyahu basically stayed in Israel after that. Their middle son went back, and his political career was launched. He started the Jonathan Institute for the Study of Terrorism, caught the eye of Moshe Ahrens, and the rest is history. That Sunday, the Knesset renamed the operation Mivtza Kadu Haram, Mivtza Yonatan. Ilan Hartuv, Dora Blach's son, worked for Teddy Kollek for many years. He just died this past November. Captain Bakos received the Legion of Honor from the French government for services. Now, many of the junior participants in the raid became well-known figures in Israeli society. Gabi Ashkenazi was the last chief of staff. Tamir Pardo is the current head of the Mossad. Effie Eitam, we know well, he's been in our shul, and others. Not because they participated, but the opposite. They participated because they had special qualities that lent themselves to leadership positions. The next day, the New York Times reported that Paris's press aide, Naftali Lavie, Rav Lau's brother, had informed them that he worked for Paris for many years. Lavie informed the Times, they wrote it, that Paris said that Rabin had long opposed any military operation, and it was only Paris's persistence that saved the day. That's what greeted Rabin Monday morning. And of course, in his memoirs, Rabin has choice words for all of this. That rivalry continued as well. The world, by and large, applauded Israel's action. Uganda brought charges against Israel in the UN. The Nazi Kurt Waldheim declared this, I quote, a serious violation of the national sovereignty of the United Nations member state. Chaim Herzog responded, we are proud of what we have done. And in fact, it was the first blow against international terror, but that war continues as well. In Israel, the raid on Entebbe dissipated a lot of the gloom of the Yom Kippur War. It was an indication that the spirit of daring and sacrifice was back. And in the years since, we look back at the raid on Entebbe with unmitigated pride and really with longing for a time when, all the hype and cliches aside, concessions were a sign of weakness, and courage to face even insurmountable challenges was the norm. And all of this was memorialized by Yehoram Gaon, who actually played Yoni Netanyahu in the Israeli version of the movie, and he sang a beautiful song someone else wrote, Eretz Tzvi, which begins, B'chatzi alayla, hem kamu v'iku b'kse olam. At midnight, they arose and they struck at the ends of the earth. Kivnei reshef chashur chiku uf, like children of the night, they hastened and went a great distance in flight, lashivet kavod adam, to restore the honor of man. El Eretz Tzvi, land of the deer, means the precious land. El Dvash Sadeh, to the honey of its fields. El Akarmel v'Hamidbar. El Am Asher Lo Yechasheh, to a nation that will not be silent. Shed Banav Lo Yafkir Lazar, that it will not abandon its children to foreigners. We only pray that that continues in the future as well. I thank you all very much. So next week we're off, President's Day, but 2 weeks we'll meet and we'll discuss 1978-79, the Camp David Accords. Thank you again.